This is tape two of the Keith Grody interview, and we're talking about collective bargaining, and we're talking about the clerical technical union when the last tape ended. Would you talk a little bit about some of the CT presidents that you dealt with?
Yeah.
Is there any long-time ones that were there?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. When the clerical technical union was first organized, and it was called MSUEA. And I remember earlier it was the Michigan State University Employees Association. And the organization formed, you know, basically as a support group for the clerical employees, because they were the biggest number, but the leadership was actually out of the technical employees. That shifted after, you know, the first year or two. And there has been a group of leadership. Barbara Reeves probably is the one who's been around for the whole time up to date. In and out of presidencies, but always part of a leadership group. The biggest issues we've had with that particular union had to do with people they hired from outside to be their professional help. The relationship actually with the employees really has never been that bad. That doesn't mean we've always agreed, but we've been able to build that relationship over the years with the people on board. We had a bigger problem with people that they brought in. In the last 10 years or more, that relationship has worked quite well. The attorney that represents them, while clearly fighting for their interests and makes no bones about it. I mean, but you know where he stands. I mean, there's a trust that you can build there. You may disagree, but you don't have to be disagreeable kind of relationship. And that's been true across most all of our unions. It's been a relationship that's matured quite well. And probably the biggest sign of its maturity happened within the last 5 or 6 years, when we simply made an agreement that health care was such an important part of the relationship and the cost that we were going to handle health care with all the unions together at the same time in coalition. And instead of dealing with them one union at a time, each, and the model has been we had eight unions at the time, we'd do 4 1-year, for the next year, have a year off, and so we do 3-year contracts, and then we start with the 4 again. And instead of doing healthcare this way, when you're trying to keep it in one group, we simply made an agreement with the unions to carve out healthcare from all the contracts, deal with it with representatives of all the unions sitting with us together. And then when we came to an agreement, put that agreement back into each of the contracts. That is a very unique model that is not, you won't find other places. Mm-hmm. And it has worked very well for us. After having done that for a couple of rounds of bargaining, we then went to us in the last round of bargaining where we not only carved out the health care, but we carved out the wage increases as well. And so the health care and wage increases are dealt with as a package, and then after the agreement are put back into their own contract. And by put back in, I mean each union has to ratify that agreement independently, even though it was done across as a group. And when they ratify it, then it's in effect amended into their contract. What that means is that this present round of bargaining that they've been going through, hardly anybody knows is going on, because wages and benefits are already settled. So the things that they're talking about are working condition kinds of things, seniority issues, promotional issues, that kind of stuff. And bargaining, instead of taking months and hours, is taking, and sometimes days and just a few weeks, and they've got a contract settled. So it's gone from a long, protracted month after month, you know, hours and hours and hours of table work, one union at a time, to a much more collegial kind of problem-solving approach, where they identify the issues, they sit down and they array alternatives, and work at solving these, as opposed to hard-nosed banging across the table on issues. So it's in the years between the late 60s, middle to late 70s, where things were very confrontational and unions were just forming and getting going, into the 80s, where we still had a lot of confrontation, into the 90s, and now turn of the century, it's really a very different kind of labor relations than we had before. Mm-hmm. And some of that simply come with the leadership maturity on both sides, both we have a long-term relationships. There's been a change now. I stepped out of my position a year ago, last January, so in 30 years to the day that I took on the position. And then July 1st of this year, Sam Baker, who's been the negotiator working at the table for the last 24 years, has retired. So all of a sudden, there's a change. There are people still from the human resources and so on that are still there that have been around, but the leadership change has taken place. And so, but that'll happen too, and has happened with some of the union leadership. These people have come up to retirement age or whatever. So there's been some turnover there, but you know, there'll need to be a readjustment to new faces, but I think the groundwork has been laid for a much more constructive. You know, most people read about unions and read about strikes and read about confrontation, but the reality is most union management relations are not like that. The reality is most union management relationships reach contracts without strikes, work on problems, have a day-to-day relationship. That doesn't mean they always agree on things, but they get things settled, they get problems solved. And that's where we are, and that's where it didn't come easily, and it didn't come right away. It took years to build that.
Has your replacement been permanently named? Or?
Yes. Yeah. There was an interim, Denise Anderton, who had started with me as a student employee, as an undergraduate student employee, worked benefits, worked through a number of offices, went away, came back, then worked for me for years and then retired. Then she was brought back on an interim basis. Then she has been replaced by a permanent replacement in Pam Beamer, who also had started with me as my administrative assistant, who then went away and was at Oakland University and Stroh Brewery Company and Sparrow Hospital. And then I brought her back a few years ago from Sparrow. And she headed the benefits unit and so on. She's now been named my permanent replacement as of I guess it happened in June of 2003.
Mm-hmm. And Sam Baker's replacement, is that an interim now, or is that?
No, there's an interim. Jim Nash, who has worked as his assistant for years, is handling an interim, but there's a nationwide search going on right now for his replacement.
You mentioned women's salaries, and there were some inequities mm-hmm. initially. Mm-hmm. Was there any proponents of, or who brought this to the attention of the administration?
Well, one of the major issues with the clerical bargaining was a women's equity, salary equity issue. When I first came on the faculty and even in the administration, there used to talk about faculty wives, you know, or student wives, I'm sorry. Student wives were the clerical employees. And I had to keep pointing out to them that may have been the case,
you know, post-World War II or post-Vietnam War, but it certainly wasn't the case in the 70s. And but seniority of a clerical employee would probably be on the average in the 3 to 4 year range, okay, where the clerical, where the seniority of an administrative professional might be in the 11 to 12 year range on the average. Over the years of the 70s, 80s, into the 90s, those, that seniority piece became almost exactly the same across all the unions. Now, some of your smaller unions, like power plant and stuff, at one point had 17, 18 years average seniority, but as there's been turnover with retirements, that's come mm-hmm. down some. But we went from a situation where it wasn't a student wife working to while the husband went to school. We were clearly working into a professional workforce. And that change came on fairly subtly, but it was clear that this meant a whole different kind of wage structure for clerical employees. And so one of the big issues early on with clerical employees was to get them market equity, to get, and you know, then the question became, well, who is our market? You know, who do we compare with? And of course, the easy one for people to say, well, we'll compare to state employees. And right away, we had to say, no, you know, we aren't going to compare with state employees because state employees are paid across the state based on the highest common denominator, which is Detroit, okay? There's a ruling that you can't have a differential based on where the person is within the state. So they had to go for the highest market, which was Detroit. Well, that was higher than we were. That wasn't Lansing, so we didn't have to go with state employees. Nor did we have to go with General Motors necessarily either. So we really had to decide just who were we going to be, you know, just what was going to be our market. And we just, over the years, had worked to try and stay kind of in between the state employee market and the private sector, local, small business market, which is where we've been, you know, tried to stay all along and have been pretty successful. But that did mean we needed to do something special for clerical employees who were predominantly women. And over the first few contracts, that was done. There was extra money poured in, not unlike they've done for women faculty salaries, in order to correct those. That issue, I think, I mean, it can always be raised again, but I think the issue has basically was taken care of within the first round, few rounds of collective bargaining contracts. Mm-hmm. The other issue that was a huge issue among all of the employee groups was job security. The way the system had been set up is that seniority didn't really mean much, and that unit administrators across campus were really had the power of the prince in their fiefdom type of situation and could pretty well run their budgets, hire who they wanted to, get rid of who they wanted to, promote who they wanted to, and that it was not unusual for someone to be told, well, you've been here a long time, your salary's too high. If you want this position, you'll have to take a salary decrease or something of that order. And that became a huge issue at the bargaining table. And it resulted early on in a whole system where people had the right to be interviewed, even limits on who could be interviewed, based on seniority and qualifications for jobs, to get around that problem of people being, in effect, loyal to the organization, staying here, earning more salary, but then having it work against them when it came time to get promotions. So that was a huge, major issue that was a part of early contracts, particularly with the clerical employees, but it was also an issue with the administrative and professional employees. And their contracts clearly address those issues, even to this day. There's always, when you're talking about promotion and seniority for promotions and so on, there's also the correlation of having seniority for layoffs and so on. But we've had so little in the way of layoffs that we haven't had to test that much. There have been layoffs. There always are layoffs when grants run out and so on. But the system gives preference to those people in getting back into the system on other vacancies as long as they have qualifications and so on. And in some cases, there have been severance payments where people have very unique skills and they can't get back in. There have been ways to cushion that exit. But again, that was a huge issue, which over time the parties worked out ways to deal with this. And as long as we don't have massive layoffs, we won't have a problem. If we ever have massive layoffs, the system of bumping and so on is frankly so complicated that it will, I'm afraid, tie things up in knots. But it's not likely that we'll have that. We have enough turnover because of soft money that generally cushions this. Turnover has decreased significantly. Early years, clerical turnover was 25% or more a year.
Per year.
And now turnover is probably down in the 7-8% category. And counting retirements, if you take out the retirements, it's probably half of that. Mm-hmm. So that we've really professionalized the workforce. Unlike all the stuff you hear about the private sector with high turnover and people don't stay for a long time, people do stay for a long time here. Mm-hmm. And as a result, from a human resource, we've had to think more about how do we continually train and upgrade the skills of people. We can't just hope that people are going to turn over and leave. And you'll bring in someone with skills, people don't turn over and leave. So you have to have programs to improve people's skills, bring them along. This was a huge issue as we went through the technology, bringing in computers instead of typewriters and so on. That was a major shift, that whole technology shift, because that changed the way significantly work was done by the clerical employee. Mm-hmm. And it also increased the number of technical employees that we had. But through that, you can see a demographic shift. Clerical employees today are under 2,000. They were over 2,400 at one time. Mm-hmm. AP employees were at one point about 900, 600 to 900. Now they're 1,300, 1,400. So the shift has been to a much more professional workforce. Mm-hmm. To a workforce that I think is better aligned with faculty. Mm-hmm. Faculty, of course, have had to take up the computer, do a lot more of their own mm-hmm. manuscript drafting and so on, which used to be turned over to clerical employees. They don't have that clerical support, so they're doing more of that themselves, and many of them would prefer to do it themselves now that they have those kind of skills. So you've seen a real demographic shift in the kind of workforce we have. And, you know, one of the issues that's come up over and over over the years is the whole issue of outsourcing. Whether or not we should, as a workforce, reduce our workforce in certain areas and shift the work out. Probably one of the easiest areas to explain is the whole food service area. You know, there are all kinds of organizations and lots of other universities who have outsourced their whole food service operation.
Include the dormitories?
Yeah. We haven't, okay? And largely, one, because of volume. We're big enough that we have the volume that other places don't have. And two, it's been our human resource policies. How, in fact, we have utilized that workforce and kept it economically viable that we don't need to outsource. Now, the issue of outsourcing continually comes up. It's continually reviewed and across a whole array of jobs. But by watching how we do things, how we pay, how we manage our workforce, in many places we haven't found the economic advantage to do that. And the economic advantage has to be significant, because to bargain that out of contract, even though we've protected the right of subcontracting in our contract, we have the right to do that, the displacement of all of those employees would be a major, major labor relations issue. So even when we do some of this, we do it transitionally over time, move people to other assignments, retrain them to do other stuff or whatever, so that there's a tremendous job security, which in part can explain why we have good labor relations.
Mm-hmm. How did the, for the CTs, how did the job classification system develop?
Well, there was always, quote, a system, okay? When I first came on board, the system was really kind of the director of personnel deciding out of his hip pocket, this is a clerical one or two, and this is a clerical three. I mean, it was done by people who did it every day, but it was done without a lot of documentation, without, you know, a real systematized way of doing it. One of the early things that I was faced with was having a classification study. And classification studies are not fun. They are very difficult. They're highly emotionally charged, because you're now talking about people's salaries. You're talking about their promotional future. You're talking about their perceived value, not only within the organization, but one person to another. They're tough. But we had to do them. We had to create a system, because pay is, your classification system is what determines pay. I mean, the reason for a classification system basically is to determine pay. Now, the other reason for a classification system is to let people know what's expected of them. You know, what are the job duties? What training and development do they need to do those job duties, and so on? But the basic function is to set up a system that differentiates pay across different skills and so on, and to take very different kinds of jobs and put them in some kind of an equated way for pay purposes. So you got jobs that don't look alike, but you have to give them some value in order for pay. We've done this. Again, we had to do it in a union environment, which means bringing the unions into it up to their ears, even to the level sitting on appeals panels and everything else. But once we got it in place, then I created behind that a professional staff who were charged to keep it up to date and to modify it and fix it as you go, rather than letting it get out of whack and then having to start from scratch throughout the whole thing and start all over again. In fact, to the point where probably 10 to 15 years, halfway through my time, I said to my staff, we will never do this again. You will keep it up to date. You will fix it as we go. We are not going to go through this again because it is very expensive. You have to bring in outside consultants and so on, but it's also very expensive and lost time, because you've got all the employees filling out forms about what they do and how they do it and how much time they spend on it and so on. And then you've got all these committees reviewing all of this and ranking it, and you've got appeals procedures and the time it takes for that and the lost productivity that goes along with that. It has to be done, I guess, every once in a while, but it kind of, the measure of how well your system's working is how often you don't have to do it. But by giving the unions the right to raise issue at any time along the way, any day, they can raise an issue on a job and have it looked at, you don't have that buildup of people saying, I'm not being treated fairly. They have a way of bringing that forward and having it dealt with on an ongoing basis. And that takes a lot of the pressure off the system. And also not having to take all of this to the trustees every time an adjustment was made made it much easier for the for an adjustment to just be made and taken care of. Now, it within the bureaucracy, it does cause stresses because you get new fields. For instance, the whole computer field came on, and you had a growth very fast with the number of people with the skills limited. And so their market demand position was greater than their position would be in a normal classification system. They could demand a market position or salaries higher than we would say they'd be paid. Then you have to set up secondary systems to say, okay, we'll do this on an exception basis, but we're not going to change the system. We'll take care of these exceptions, but as the skill pool catches up, as the availability of talent catches up, it'll all fall back. And if you do that, you don't have to keep redoing the system all the time. Some systems didn't do that. They set up whole elaborate systems only to have to change the whole thing again years later when everybody started having these skills and there was an abundance of people in these skills. Mm-hmm. But if you have a classification that people think is fair, that is open and reviewable, and that is the basis then from which you make your salary increases. One of the early issues, it was a huge issue, was the issue of promotional ladders. Okay, people wanted to know, if I start here, how do I get to this level up here? What do I have to do? How many years do I have to be in this job and so on? And again, I took the position that a promotional ladder is what you look at after you've had your career and you look backwards and say, oh, here's how I got here. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's no one way for everybody to get to their position. You know, you can anecdotally talk to people, how'd you get to where you are? And then you shake your head and say, my gosh, how'd that ever happen? You know. But people needed to know that they could, in fact, advance, and they needed to know that in gathering more skills and experience, that had value, and that we would, in fact, help them do that. And so we've, over the years, created systems that will support people as they go back to school, paying for tuition and so on, and that's true with most of our bargaining units, where they can take classes and have the tuition reimbursed and so on. And that once they get these things, they make themselves then eligible for opportunity. And that took a lot of the heat off the system where people felt that they were in these lower level jobs and there was no way to get out. But by creating systems and supporting that, that was an issue that tended to, it may still be there for an individual or two, but on a systemic basis, it's not there anymore.
In the most recent group on campus to unionize, of course, was the graduate teaching assistants. Mm-hmm. To what degree were you involved in that?
Only a little bit, because Sam Baker from my office worked with Bob Banks. I was involved early on when we were on the early discussions about the election and the definition of the bargaining unit and that type of stuff. And in fact, when they did the vote, I was there representing the university in the vote count and so on. But at the bargaining table, this was done with the dean of the graduate school, the provost, and our office serving as the technical staff to help them do this. They actually sat at the table. It was also being done just as I was leaving my position. So, because the staff reported to me, I knew what was going on, I knew what the issues were, and I knew mm-hmm. what the progress was. But I was not as involved in it. Over the years with the other units, actually I would work with the administration to get the parameters of what we could do and so on, and I would give the direction to the whoever was doing the bargaining at the table as to here's what authority, they would check with me as to could they put more money on the table or that kind of stuff. That wasn't the case with the grad students. That was but that had been the case for many years with all the other bargaining. Mm-hmm. The model that I created and followed all of those years was that there are two bodies you negotiate with, the body you represent and the body across the table from you. And so I set it up so that I negotiated with the body that we represent. In other words, I worked with the central administration and the trustees. And the person who worked for me then worked across the table. Now that got a little fuzzy over the years because when we went to coalition bargaining on healthcare, I then actually went and sat at the table for that. And I did early in my years actually did some of the bargaining at the table, like with the clerical contract or early clerical contracts. What happened later on is that the meeting with the board, we used to meet with the board and brief the board on what was coming, and then as we did bargaining, we'd go back and brief them and so on. We had less contact with the board later on, just briefing the president and the vice president and the provost, and they did most of the board work. And that change came more with us with Peter McPherson as president than prior to that. Prior to that,